Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson. And normally we have our co-host, Kenny Cepeda, who is taking the week off.
No Kenny.
A little housekeeping here. We're online at what-s-left.webno.com. Please subscribe, rate, review, share your favorite episode, turn on your notifications wherever you found this episode. Thank you. I want to stress it's very important for people to really take note of our blog if one day we are banned from YouTube. I'm being serious.
It's true.
All right. So, Andy, you and I are here.
Yes, hello. It's like old times.
Yes.
Except it used to be us sitting on a couch, kind of awkwardly straining our necks to try to talk to each other. And now we're separated by, I don't know, how many miles? 7-8 miles?
You live in Oakland and I live in San Francisco. So.
Yeah. And no Kenny, you know, which is unfortunate. But he was just like, I'm going to take a break this week. And We decided to take on what I think is going to be a bit of a challenging issue, which is, I would call it the Chicago Teachers Union strike, although they wouldn't call what they're doing a strike. I'm fine with calling it, at the least we can say it's a collective work action that's being proposed. And it's an interesting puzzle for people like myself, and you, Eduardo, and for and teachers like AJ, who we've come out and said we believe schools should be reopened, or at the very least we say we believe we as workers should return to our schools. It's kind of a different thing on my part when I say that. And we've actually worked with some people. We've made a statement with other people who want to go back to the schools. And of course, in our statement, we've said everyone who's ready to come back should come back. And if people aren't ready to go back, those people could stay remote. But we do feel, both AJ and I feel like we need to get back to our workplace, to what we would call our center of power as members of the working class. And that's not what is being decided by Chicago teachers, by and large, and not what the Chicago Teachers Union is doing. So while I support the idea of organized action, and I actually support the direction of collective action to withhold your work, I would not vote. If a similar vote was here in San Francisco, and there could be a similar vote here in San Francisco, I would vote not to take the action they're taking. So this is a challenging moment to talk about that and to talk about why I would do that.
Andy, is it all right if I can begin by stating, premising this episode with something? We are going to be discussing, as you said already, the organizing efforts of Chicago teachers. It's around reopening schools, and it's a very charged discussion. And the discussion is so charged that a lot of times in my circles, people don't want to speak about the issue with me anymore. And I'm not part of the right. I think more of a progressive and sometimes even voter of a Democrat than you or Kenny, our other co-host. And I've just been feeling like this conversation that we're going to have around the Chicago teachers, about the reopening of schools, anything around COVID, anything about the virus, is just so politically charged right here. And I just thought, as I had told you on the phone, I thought we should start off by stating that what's left stands for, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Because we have stated many times in episodes, but I have people who don't look at every episode.
Right.
And we have, and we might change the way that we intro it, but this is what's left is for. What's left is a place, a hub, and place to share, exchange, debate ideas as we try to sort it out for ourselves. it's a place for us to be able to safely, civilly disagree with one another. And hopefully in the disagreement that you and I have, for example, we can model for what it may look like to organize with other people who are on the left, which as of right now, as we have seen, many people tend to be canceled out. It's what is the norm of these days, that you're either in alignment with what I believe or think, or you're not. And if you're not, you are excluded and you are silenced or you're censored or you're pushed away or defriended, all of these ways. And I understand sometimes some of it. You and I may disagree about that, but for me, I personally understand some of it, right? Some people just are really trolling, or some people are really just getting on people. You know, it's sometimes some people's pain, especially about their identity, gets really personal. But here on What's Left, we do aim and strive to be able to have and hold conversations that are not popular and that will possibly get us in trouble in certain circles. But I hope not, because we're supposed to be able to share these ideas and challenge them. If anyone wants to, they're willing to come to What's Left, they can challenge anything that we say here. And that's all I want to just remind people. As well as Andy has his way of thinking, I have mine, and we speak for ourselves. So anything I say is what I'm speaking up for myself, and Andy speaking up. We have some agreements, but we will debate each other and we'll disagree with our framework, our way of going about things to do, to organize. Everyone is welcome to share and discuss their points of view and can challenge them. And if you're bothered, again, I invite you. I cannot help what Andy says, or Andy cannot help what I say. But I invite you to come on What's Left and be able to discuss these ideas. We're open to it, and if you don't want to do it publicly online, you can do it offline with us. Wanted to state that.
Yeah.
By the way, I did like someone. You sent me an email of a listener or a viewer that sent us something. That was really nice and sweet. Whoever's listening,
snappy.
Snappy.
Yeah, I liked it.
So, So anyhow, I just want to put that out there. And thank you, Snappy, for your comment on our blog.
But I agree with what you're saying, Eduardo. We did talk in the early episodes and have returned to the idea that we wish that the working class movement, the left, was better able to discuss and debate ideas. But we also, and you say it every week, we also recognize that some of the things we are saying are meant to challenge what is considered the mainstream left. And at a time like this, when I think positions that we have are very unpopular on the mainstream left, and even on the revolutionary left, we're just going to have to understand that we're going to be isolated. That is something I don't necessarily welcome, but I'm going to say what I believe. I'm not going to say that I'm right, but I'm going to say that I have a reason for believing it. And that is the left and the working class movement we want, is where people feel free to say what they think needs to happen to actually change the world, because that's what's going to have to happen. The world is going to have to be changed, not by the capitalist class, because they're changing it right in front of us, but by workers. And to do that, we're going to have to be able to freely talk about the ideas about how to do that.
As well as, I also wanted to state that you and I had a conversation that I was going to feel nervous around this conversation. And I just want to be transparent about that.
Yeah.
I just want to state out loud that I have to tread very gingerly around the subject of COVID, because it's a very sensitive topic for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I will, and people are going to disagree with me. I sent a few things out to a few friends. Some things that we have shared online on Facebook or other areas, and people have reacted very strongly. So I'm very afraid of, I know I jokingly say I'm going to lose friends, but I am afraid of how people view me judgmentally. But I'm going to speak about how I see it, and if you disagree, talk about it, as I said, with me, you know?
Yeah. So do you want me to say a little, you wanted me to give a little background or?
Yeah, why don't you?
Okay. Yeah. So the first thing to know is in 2012, there was a Chicago teacher strike. It was about smaller class sizes and stopping the closing of schools and and things like that. And it was very popular. It had a lot of public support. I think the strike came down too early, but the very least you can say is the Chicago Teachers Union did lead a strike for about 7 days, 7 work days, I think it was. And it had immense support from the public, feeling like the teachers union was fighting the good fight. So it was the teachers workers supported by parents and supported really by the city, except for the, you know, the elites, who wanted to break it and, who essentially, dealt with it for the 7 days and then tried to chip away in those subsequent years after that and have been successful at doing some of that, because the Chicago Teachers Union hasn't gone on strike since then. But nevertheless, they went on strike, and that's important. And our union and here in San Francisco has never gone on strike in my time, hasn't done it in 40 years, and that's to our detriment, and to the detriment of the working class. And this year, it was proposed that they might have to go back to school back in August of 2020. And the union said, no, we're not going to go back to school. We're going to stay remote. And the CPS, Chicago Public School District, or Chicago Public Schools, acquiesced. And so I think for the first 6 months or the first semester, the Chicago Public Schools have been all remote. Then in January 4th or so, students who had special needs or pre-K were invited to return, and the teachers were said, you got to return as well. Like, and that's not a majority of the teachers, that's some of the teachers had to return. And from what I understand, I think only 60% of the teachers returned and 19% of the students returned who could return. But nevertheless, that happened in January. And I imagine, I don't know, there was probably some fight over that. Well, the CPS, Chicago Public Schools, just I think in the last week or two, I don't know when it was, but basically said, now we want kindergarten through eighth grade to return. And I don't know how many students that totally represents. The Chicago Public Schools serves about 400,000 students, and the Chicago Teachers Union has about 25,000 members, and that includes teachers and paraprofessionals, if I understand, and probably others like librarians and stuff like that. And from my understanding, if to return to school, that would be about 10,000 workers would have to return. And teachers are saying, and the unions are saying, and the members are saying something that I've heard here in San Francisco, because it's the same thing, which is it's not safe. We can't go back. And so they have voted to not return and to stay to an all remote. I think it was 86% of their members voted, and of that 86% who voted, over 70% voted to not return and to stay at just a remote learning. And so this is where things are at with the district. And the district has threatened.
How many voted?
What's that?
How many voted to go back to school?
About 71%, I think it was, of the 80s. No, not to go back, to not return.
Yeah, but what percentage was there to go back, if there was one?
That must be, that might have been 29%. Okay.
Sorry, continue.
Yeah. And so this is where things are at. There's going to be a kind of, a stalemate or a fight now over teachers saying no, and the teachers union largely saying we're going to stay out of school and stay remote, and the district saying no, you got to go back in. And you know, the district of course is being heavy-handed. There are people who've been asked for ADA exemptions before because of either their own concerns about COVID, or they have concerns about COVID back at home. And from what I've heard, the district has not been willing to honor some of those. So I'm not surprised that the district is a thug. And the district is essentially trying to say, we can tell you what to do. And I, at one level, I support the idea of workers saying, you can't tell us what to do. We're not going to do it. And that spirit I support. But I would say that that's about as much as I support. I support the idea of organizing and people doing something together, that. But if this was in San Francisco, like I said, I would vote no. I would vote to return. And I would lose that vote, but I wouldn't want to be clear. I would not cross a picket line, if you will. I would honor what my union and and my workers decided to do, even though I think it's the wrong thing to do. I want to be clear about that. Because I'm not going to really say for my union or union leadership, but I do believe that ultimately, if we're going to get through this, it's going to be through a collection of workers acting in the right way. And I would not call what the Chicago teachers are doing. They're taking the wrong move together to fight what is coming. And I actually think it's going to have the effect of splitting them off from their parent and student base. And I actually think they're reinforcing, by staying with remote learning, a larger threat that is coming to our students. So I could probably get more into it, but I think I need to, there's a few things I want to say, because I want to speak about safety and what is safety. And I want to speak about the future, because safety is a term that is used a lot when it's saying why teachers shouldn't return.
Yeah, this is a challenge, no? Because I also thought about, in these past days, what we have discussed about the teachers union collectively deciding by majority that they wouldn't want to return. How would I personally, if I was, right now I'm on the other side, right? I'm on the family side right now. I'm not contract hired, or I'm not working, excuse me.
Yeah.
I'm not working for the district or so. But how would I, if I was back there with my, if I was in Chicago as an educator, how would I do this? I really, myself, I would be a part of that group of teachers and educators that would want to return back to school. And I thought long and hard, and I thought maybe I would go back just to support the students. That was my first initial reaction. And now I just think that I'm going along with what I would possibly do, which is support my union, but my union members, my colleagues, and work within them, talk with them to try to convince them or to discuss this, to have a forum on this, to argue. I think that would be my next step. I think I wouldn't fight them. Excuse me, I wouldn't cross the picket line. Mm-hmm. I almost don't want to even use that word, because I understand why some people would do it, you know?
They can do that, but that's what it is. It's a picket line.
And yeah.
We make no bones about it. Our members, this would be the same thing in San Francisco. Overwhelmingly, our members here have said, we don't want to return because of safety reasons.
So I know that some teachers would go because of their relationship with their students and wanted to do something for them.
Right.
Now, so that's, I think, where I would be. My next step, if I was in that position, I would discuss or find ways to hold forums with my colleagues and challenge them on why they're thinking the way they are.
Right. Well, and that's what I want to talk about right now, because I agree with you that because for me, going back to school has never, and going back to my workplace, isn't really centered on just what's best for the students, at least not in terms of their education, because you have to remember, their education back in February, before we left that workplace, was a
capitalist
is an indoctrination center to prepare them for future exploitation. Okay, that's what that education was. So that place was not safe for them back there, because I was preparing them for wage slavery and to accept that. Okay, the difference is, and there's really no difference today. It's just that wage slavery and the danger of the world that's being prepared for them is being accelerated. And to continue with this remote learning, I'll talk a little bit more about that in terms of the future, is preparing them for a very dangerous future, all right? And so I can't pretend to say, oh, I'm teaching you so that you can go into the future of the fourth industrial revolution.
I'll clarify. When I talk about returning to school, I'm not necessarily talking about so they can do well in their education. I see schools, so we have discussed before, what schools should be like as places for connection, mental health, well-being, as well as places for organizing. And that's what I would, it's not, and to protect them, from data-driven, big profit consumerist, profit-driven companies of data. I'm just saying that, Andy. I don't know if I want to include this little piece, but I just want to tell you that that's what I'm thinking. And we still may have differences. I know we have differences around why we see what we see schools for. But I'm telling you on a personal level, it's not just that I see it for education. I don't just see it for their maths.
Well, and I see it as our base of it's where we need to return collectively to wage a fight for the future of humanity. Right. That's why I want to return to school to start that fight. And we can't fight from these computers and locked into these little boxes. And I guess I want to start with this notion of safety, which keeps coming up. Safety for our students, safety for us. And I'm going to share my screen, Eduardo, because we don't have everyone. Not everyone here is on YouTube. So what are we showing here?
Yeah. So you are sharing your screen on some percentages about survival rates by age group of COVID-19. And this is the CDC source that you've had. And this is an estimated infection fatality rate for COVID-19. Yeah.
Right. And for our students, basically, it's a 0.003% chance of dying. For most teachers between the ages of 20 and 49, what they're saying is a 0.02% chance of dying. If you're a teacher between 50 and 69 in that elderly group, you have they estimate a 0.5% chance of dying. And of course, the largest group has a chance of fatality rate. And this is what is a feature of COVID, is the people 70 and older. So these are the numbers. This is CDC numbers about the fatality rates of COVID. Okay, that's the first thing I want to say. And this is basically using CDC numbers to compare COVID's fatality rate to seasonal influenza, all right? And if you look at it, people here looking at it on YouTube, or listening on podcast, you can again see that the areas where the biggest risks are to be had are groups 70 and older, and that the fatality rate for COVID is about three times more for people over 70 than it is for influenza. Okay, this is again, Eduardo, you don't even agree with my statement. This is why I say, well, COVID is essentially the flu. Okay, and so that's one thing I want to say about safety. But there's another thing I want to say about safety, and it gets us back to the struggle that's going on in India right now. This is a picture of. So the Indian farmers are protesting some laws which are basically going to strip them of their land. And this is the Indian workers and farmers basically occupying the Red Fort, which is a very important government building. All right. Everyone's talking about government buildings being taken over. This was taken over by Indian farmers. And it's a historic and important landmark in India. And this is another headline right here talking about India during India protests, farmers armed with sticks and spears clash with police in Delhi, all right? And this is a struggle that is currently happening right now in India. And here is what one reporter in this, not reporter, I should say, one observer, and this person wrote a letter to the Corbett Report about that struggle. And here's what they wrote. They said, the farmers have understood that the new farm laws that they are protesting will take away local middlemen and install huge corporations in their place. These corporations have already greedily bought up large warehouses, and much before the laws passed under the cover of corona lockdowns. Okay, and then he continues. When I went to the protest site yesterday, what struck me was the number of teeming humanity, old people, children, young women and men eating together, hugging, joyfully dancing to protest songs, and not wearing masks. Not one of them. I asked, aren't you afraid of corona? They laughed and said, why should we be afraid of something that's not there? During the heyday of the virus, we had been protesting in the biting cold of Punjab and then Delhi. We are afraid of these new rules. It will take away the last shred of land and the peasant holds and push it to the corporations. it is there that we are afraid, but Corona is not there. That's my opening bid to talk about what we're facing, is this notion of safety. First, workers have to understand this notion of safety for us is a myth. There is no safety under capitalism for workers. The workers and farmers in India understand that. They understand that their biggest threat is corporations who are gobbling up the globe, gobbling up resources, and taking things from them and giving them no future, taking away the future. That is just as true in the United States as it is in India, all right? And so the notion that we have safety by being spread apart is completely backwards. Our only safety as workers is coming together and actually fighting, and fighting with sticks and spears, and fighting with whatever we can, the police, our state institutions, corporate institutions, corporations, and taking back what is ours. That is the only safety that exists in society for us. And it's understandable that workers don't understand that. Because there's been so much fear spread around coronavirus, so much. I mean, that has really been locked down and stay 6 feet of separation, all that kind of stuff. So I do get that. But the idea that socialists would be talking about safety under capitalism is completely backwards. Socialists know that the world is divided between capitalists and the working class, and that there's a constant war between those two. And that for the most part, we know as socialists that that war has been a one-sided war where the capitalists are screwing us constantly. And the idea that there's any safety to be found by just preserving yourselves or holding tight is, it's one thing for a worker to say that, but for any socialist to go out there and say that there's anything safe about not struggling and not struggling together against a common enemy and struggling, and that struggle must look like what it looks like in India. It is not a struggle to maintain separation. It is not a struggle that allows ourselves to be divided, which is what's happening in Chicago. And this is why CPS is pushing that line. They're trying to break up. I mean, they know the union was going to take that position, and they know the parents are going to see that as a position that they oppose. So they're trying to break up associations that existed back in 2012 even further, and they're going to take advantage of that. They're even probably going to try to bust the union through some of this stuff. The only safety we have is by going and basically taking back our workplaces, probably by force, ultimately by force, and spreading that struggle across the country. So that's the first thing I want to say as it relates to the notion of safety. There's another thing to be talked about, is that there might be a notion of remote learning as being safe. I want to get to that later. So that's my opening thing I wanted to say.
So I'm in agreement with you. I'll start off simply by saying COVID-19, this virus is real. I'll just state that from now, because every time I premise it, because I don't want people to think I'm in denial that it exists. The virus is real. I don't necessarily consider myself to be an anti-vaxxer either. I want to state that, and I also agree with a lot of what you're saying. I don't know if I have questions around whether I can state that it's just like the flu, because it is a new SARS variant that I think we still have yet to find out about more information of. But I do not think it is to the highest level of super safety concern that we have to try to impose so many restrictions on people to be able to organize or to be able to get together for the sanity of our mental health. I think people's fears are real, like inside what they feel. Based on those, based on what, though, I would question. So I don't want to necessarily deny people's fears. I understand that people have legitimate fears, anxiety. And I think that they should be heard and respected if they feel that way. And I think that we should gingerly try to sort of talk about some of these things in a way that isn't shocking or sort of attacking that what they feel is there, but what the facts are, as we're seeing with what you outlined, is also there. And we need to look at that and constantly try to remind ourselves that we have worked in schools with influenza. We have worked with schools with outbreaks such as measles. We've worked in schools where there have been chickenpox. We have worked in schools where even when there was the outbreak of the pandemia that existed in 1918, and I was reading an article where schools didn't shut down necessarily. In Canada, they had what they called an open-air schools, al aire libre, and they would have their classrooms outside. People found ways to accommodate. But this sort of lockdown confinement is, especially in the USA or here in the Bay, it is there is some polarized, I think, political agenda around it, which makes it very difficult to discuss anytime, as I was saying from the outset of this episode, because it isn't an issue for conservatives or progressives or people on the left in France, in Mexico, where I'm from, or in Britain, where they've had to have very strict confinement, but their schools are still left open, or in Spain. And we've said this in other episodes. And what's also real and there for people is that one in four people aged 18 to 24 seriously contemplated suicide in June last year. And this was also new research from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Lots of people like to quote them and talk about the CDC constantly. And this is there. That's the data that is the latest, well, that at that time. And recently you shared something on your Facebook, which I appreciate, and I saw and I also read. And unfortunately, even when I shared it with some of my colleagues or former colleagues, I reacted very differently to it. And there have been a surge of student suicides in Las Vegas schools, this area of Las Vegas, and have encouraged them to reopen schools. And it's very hard to link with suicide. As well, I will say that sometimes I did have one friend that did say, you know, you can't really link suicide because suicide is mental health and it's complex. It's not just linked to one thing. It could be linked to many things. It's intersectional. I get that. But when you do see that there is a rise, as I said earlier about last year and this year, why make it so difficult for our students who are already having those challenges when sometimes schools are the safest places they can be, if they're having those issues? And these are the ones we need to look out for. And the article that you shared, which was in the New York Times, for people who just want to attack this, and I know liberals like to talk about identity politics, written by a Black writer, I should say. I shared it with some colleagues and they'll say, you know, well, they'll dismiss it, saying that this is actually being used, the mainstream news is being used to try to further the cause of reopening schools when teachers don't want to. I think, go ahead, you want to
say? I agree. Actually, I agree with that. That was the reason I posted it, because I actually do believe that the narrative is shifting with the Biden administration. The lockdown is kind of ending here in California, or at least the formal lockdown is talking about. The fear, they still want to keep the fear. They're talking about a new, more dangerous virus on the thing, on the horizon, a new version of the coronavirus. But they still want to get everyone vaccinated. They still want the contact tracing. They want the full testing, all those sorts of things that I oppose. Like I certainly oppose the idea of any mandated vaccine. And the thing that's being pumped into people, I don't think constitutes an actual vaccine because it doesn't give you any immunity. So I don't know what you call that thing. It is a drug that seems to reduce some symptoms temporarily. But it has no evidence of actually changing infection rates. So, and I think something else is going on there. I think, like I said, I think there's an experiment of new kinds of vaccines that are going to be very important and very profitable for pharmaceutical companies in the biotech industry if they can get this thing to work. But that's another thing. That's the vaccines. I also oppose the contact tracing and the and the, all the testing that they're talking about because of who's collecting that data and what it's being used for. So
can you tie that to why you also oppose remote learning? Because I think that's tied to data, and
if that's okay,
because I wanted to.
I will, but I want to. I'll get there. But I want to talk about that article I sent about the Las Vegas thing.
Because the
Vegas thing, the Vegas suicide rate, were some of the statistics were from years past, and were not necessarily clear, like, is it right now or is it past years and things like that. And I actually agree with some of the critiques that people said, like, wait, that doesn't hold up. And I'm just saying there is a conscious mainstream narrative shift to try to begin to shift things more towards reopening, although they know this is going to be hybrid schools and blah, blah, blah. And that's the cynicalness. That's the cynicism of the ruling class. They're going to make any narrative they do to get us to do what they want us to do. And that's largely what I was trying to say. The idea, though, that keeping kids separated from each other during this time, keeping them forced into stressed out households where there's economic insecurity, where there's all sorts of health fears, the idea that keeping them in those places for a whole year and locking them into that place and not being able to talk to one another is somehow not damaging to children, that's an absurdity. I don't know about suicide rates, although I do suspect those, but I know that a whole generation is being damaged by what we're doing here. But that actually isn't my biggest fear, not just the immediate damage. My biggest fear is the future of education and the future of the world. And maybe that's something I want to share my screen and show something to get to that.
Is it okay though, if I can just stick on the safety issue, before we move on to the end. We talk about safety constantly, teachers. I'm just using the word educators to broaden the term, because it's not just teachers who will have to return. It'll be parents. Yeah. It'll have to be support staff. It'll have to be even administrative coaches, whoever, reading, whoever. So I'll use the word educators. I understand that. And I just also feel that when I shared some of this stuff on mental health and as well the safety, the stuff that we even discussed with Tracy Burt and Steven Rico, it's challenging because they talk about their safety, but I look at, and I'm just going to use how liberals frame things about privilege here. But when we talk about privilege here, if we really want to go there, the safety of students over teachers, over educators, I sometimes wonder, where does a privilege lie in that? If the circles of liberals constantly bringing up privilege, when the lowest teacher salary in San Francisco is offered at $50,000 a year, that's an employee with a bachelor's and an emergency credential. That's the lowest teacher salary. And the average teacher salary paid is $79,000 a year. The highest teacher salary offered is $103,000 a year. And most teachers are college educated, documented, have insurance, have some high percentage of them have some form of stable, stable housing, and can work remotely. The safety, it seems, is almost the safety and concern over one, but not in the concernment, if that even is a word, over our students, when constant conversations about reparations for Black students or constant conversations about the disparities between those that have and do not have, about Black Lives Matter, our championing, the left prides itself for championing over civil rights issues, LGBTQ youth. Our Black students and our LGBTQ youth are actually at the highest rate of suicide, something happening to them at home. And all in the name of safety, but what about in the name of safety for them? And that's just maybe one point of view, the way I'm framing it. I know it's not the way that you would frame it, Angie, but I'm just saying it's one point of view, because there are many sides to this that we could look at, that I would like for people to consider when they constantly talk about the right for them to feel safety. And I ask then, is your right triumph over the right of others to feel safety then? And that's a hard conversation to have. Because a lot of teachers, I'm sorry, but I know, I don't know how to even say this, but a lot of teachers are doing the remotes at a resort place right now. I don't know how to, I don't want to say that that's a representative of a lot of teachers. It isn't. Maybe it's a small percentage, but just even the fact that you can teach anywhere and you have insurance and you're documented, you have, you know, again, the framework is different. I know that you wouldn't frame it this way, but it just feels to me a little selfish when teachers talk about the safety, but I don't know if they're talking, I don't hear them talking enough about the safety over other students. And I'm not saying that we should return, all of us. I think it should be voluntarily. I think you stated that as well, if some teachers want to or not. I'm just, that's where I feel my heart is when I think of my emotions in my heart. Now my intellectual part, my more, you know, left side of the brain, so to speak, the linear thinking, is about the fear that I think we're going to be discussing about, which is a larger conversation. And that is more of why don't you start it off about data
and I appreciate what you're saying, at least noting that you and I would put it not the same in regards to that. I do think I suffer from this myself, where with me and Brandy and Kizmo, where I do want to put my head in the sand. This, what's happening in the world is frightening, and I do want escape from it. And I do think that's probably what a lot of people, a lot of my fellow workers are doing, is thinking, how do I get away from this? How do I get away from this kind of soul killing box world that's being created? And thinking that there's maybe some temporary safety. And like I said, socialists are the ones who should know better. Socialists are the ones who'd be saying, workers, there's no safety here. There's none. There's only safety in getting together and fighting. That's it. Everything else is an illusion. The working class, we have to look at India and learn from them about where safety is to be found. And that, again, is coming together, protesting, being around each other, risking maybe spreading a virus, but there's a bigger risk of being separated and isolated and being picked apart if we don't come together and fight. And fight one, a common enemy who truly is privileged, which is the capitalist class. And the thing I want to start with is this, and I want you to see this. I don't know if you saw this video. I'm going to show it to you, and it'll be, again, our audience, but maybe you can give a summary of what we're seeing after I see it, okay? Maybe for people who aren't watching, what did we just take a look at? This is Boston Dynamics, actually, a company, Boston Dynamics.
I think you've just showed a video, and I really recommend people to look at this video.
If you're
listening on the podcast, we'll put it in the link, a link in the description notes below this episode. Three robots dancing to a song. It's and this is the future of technology.
Yes.
AI.
Yeah. And if you were, there's some words in there where they keep on saying, work, do you love me? Work. I that is not an accident. These people know what they're doing. And I show this because what we are looking at, it is the future of AI, but it's also the future of labor. These robots that you see are going to be doing manual labor in the future. And if they can't do manual labor with their AI that's going to tell them how to do that manual labor, and that's going to be replacing workers, because the capitalist class knows that to return to profitability, and that's what this last year was about. It was about recovering from an economic crisis and a recovery of profits. And in order to recover profits, you must increase productivity, you must increase efficiency. And the way you do that is It's called the organic composition of capital. You build machines and things like that that make the work that humans do more efficient and more productive. And that's what these things are about. They're also going to be part of a future military force and things like that. But I'm going to push that aside in terms of the surveillance aspect of it and the danger that these things present militarily, because what they are is a threat to any worker out there. About this is, if you had a job where you had to use your hands, then you're gone. These people are going to be doing it. And if we can't get them to do it, then what we're going to be doing is we're going to put a headset on you so that you can help control those little robots and make them do that better. All right. So that you can have a worker in San Diego and a worker in San Francisco and a worker in Nevada all be working the same factory together. All right. But they'll do it remotely. Okay. But they'll be controlling their little robot and where the AI can't get the robot to do the right thing, the human will intervene to make sure the robot does it, kind of like a drone operator in the military. That is the future of employment in this globe. That is what's called the fourth industrial revolution. That's the global reset that's being set up for us. And it's important for teachers to understand that these boxes we're putting our students into, this is not a temporary measure. These boxes, these Zoom boxes, these Zoom classes are all about preparing them for that future, where they're essentially going to be working remotely, learning remotely, and every one of us is going to be gig workers, essentially, those of us who have jobs, all right? And that world is a world, these robots are not just there to produce goods for all of us, they're there to make profits for the capitalists. And that is a world that means that manual labor is going to be replaced from humans, but also, and this is where the AI comes in, mental labor is going to be replaced. Teachers are going to be replaced. Managers are going to be replaced because this is where the data comes in. And this is why there is such a drive to collect data among the US population, among the populations in Africa, among populations in Europe, among populations in Asia. And this is why China has such a drive to collect data and the US has such a drive to collect data. It's not just about data mining so they can advertise to you. Yes, that's a big piece of it. But the biggest reason they're going to be collecting our data, and one of the ways they want to collect data, is literally right here on these screens. Collect the data of how the teachers are teaching, collect the data of how the students are responding. They're going to have our AI facial recognition, recognizing what the student's responding to. They're wearing their shirts and their gear that's giving biomedical information about how they're responding. But all that data is being used to improve the AI that's being built, all right? Because that's what it needs. It needs to iterate through data after data after data, and then make a little nudge, a little change, a little thing, and see how the data comes back and keep working on that. It's a giant game for AI, but this game is about profits and this game is about control. So when we agree to contact tracing, we're agreeing to giving up our data. When we agree to all this testing, we're agreeing to giving up our data. When we agree to being vaccinated, we're agreeing to giving up our data. We're agreeing to a biomedical matrix that's being set up for us so that we can have telemedicine, and that we're all basically making sure we give our information so we can monitor how well that vaccine is working as it's going throughout society each year. And there's no safety in that. First, I think the vaccines themselves may very well be dangerous, but even if the vaccines weren't dangerous, giving up that information and giving it to the state and giving it to corporations, Moderna, Department of Defense, these people who have that plan, that's what they plan. They want to replace us either with those machines or with AI. That is something that has to be resisted. And the only way it can be resisted is through struggle. And this is where I want to get at what I think teachers should do. Because again, I think there's lessons from India about what if we're going to resist that, because that's the thing people should be frightened of, is that future. Because it's coming, and it's not coming because of some science fiction dystopia. It's coming because we live under capitalism, and it's coming because capitalists compete for profits. And the way they're going to compete for profits is to see who can develop the most AI, who can have the most productive labor, and it's all going to come at our expense. And it's going to eventually, in my mind, lead to war between China and the United States. But it will not be stopped unless we can come together as a class and take this shit out of their hands.
I agree with a lot of what you say. I don't know if I'm with the vaccines, though. I do. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. As I said, I do have I'm not too sure about this vaccine. I will wait. There was a physics teacher once who told me that did not take BART for at least a year, and said that he was a physics teacher, and he said, I wouldn't take BART at all. I waited for a whole year. Everyone else could take it, but that's how I view this vaccine. I'm going to wait a very long time. I will not sign up. I have hesitation, as much as people would, the WHO would like to say that the hesitation is actually an issue, a problem, but I think it's a good thing. We should have some form of hesitation. So that's the only issue I take with you in that area. And we have those differences there. But I do agree a lot of what you say. And I, as I mentioned in an episode before, I remember being a kid and going to Universal Studios, and there was some roller coaster thing or something where you went to go see the Terminator. And a lot of the things that we discussed that they were portraying because of the Terminator is suddenly becoming true now. And it's so sci-fi and it feels out of this world, but it is happening. And your video shows exactly the world that we are going to live into. And because these things happen slow and they're not fast changed, I imagine that people are slowly integrating it as a part of our humanity, our culture, our way of living, our society, and that is something we'll just have to live into. The future of AI. So I fear for that. I think these conversations are important, and I'm glad you stated what you stated. And I have a very strong agreement with you in the 99% of what you've shared. I just think that it's hard sometimes. I'm wondering, how do we share this? Alison's work, the work that you've just laid out for us here with our folks, when I think people don't think there's some cognitive dissonance that happens around it. I don't know. It's something about not seeing the future, and that's how we are as humans. No, we don't look at the future consequences. We think about the now and what's happening to me at this moment. But we don't think of the profession of or any profession for that matter, because AI is going to turn up anywhere in every profession now. But we're speaking specifically to this episode about teachers. So I'm going to speak about that. But teachers don't look at their profession in jeopardy. They see this profession as, well, I'm in jeopardy, but not the profession itself is in jeopardy. And I feel that that is a disconnect.
Yeah. And I think that's the difference between India and the people in Punjab and Delhi and the farmers there and us as workers here, is they have not allowed themselves to be isolated, and they have not, and we have. And that position of isolation makes you think of, what is my solution? What is my single solution to it? It can be to escape. It can be to, you know, do various things to be like, okay, how do I get through this? Because there is no, there is no collective of us right now. I mean, and again, that's the one element of the Chicago thing. Yeah, that is the one element of the Chicago thing that I think is important, is people remembering, oh, we do something together. And that's why I wouldn't, even if they voted against what I thought we should do, and I do want to talk about what I think we should do, then I would go with the teachers, or I would go with my fellow workers and say, we are doing the wrong thing here, comrades. And we need to turn this, because this is going to come against us. We're waging a fight, which is good, but we're fighting the wrong force. The force we need to fight is that future for our children. And we will not fight that future by forcing our kids to learn remotely. That's just not a future for the children. That's our future as well. Although, like, I'll be honest, I'll be retiring 6 or 7 years from now. So I'm on the back end of that. I might have a pension. We'll see what happens with the economy. Inflation might be so high that it wipes it out. And that's what Rob, our guest, you know, from the bankers brought up. Who knows? I don't think anybody other than the capitalists right now can be happy about the future. And that's what I do believe. That is a message we need to deliver to our fellow workers. And I wouldn't be able to deliver that message with any sort of legitimacy if I crossed the line.
I see. I wanted to just bring up the point that I once said to a former colleague of mine that Mexico and France was reopening schools. And they said, well, Mexico, sort of like, well, Mexico, like, well, you can't really count. And I'm like, what? And why am I bringing that up? Because I can almost see the arrogance of some people. And this is a problem on the left where they'll say something, well, India, in a very patronizing, yeah, condescending way, as if, well, they're organizing because they don't have the means to work remotely, et cetera. And, you know, all these ways to justify why they're organizing the way they do. I think it is very condescending and their struggle is real.
It's a colonizer mindset. It's a colonizer mindset from people who themselves are being colonized, because that's what's happening. And Allison would admit our bodies are being taken over. Our data is being taken over. We are being separated. Prison members in solitary confinement. And yet we have this colonizer mind. And this is where we get to racism. This is where we get to people thinking, oh, there must be something like different about those people and in reality, what people are doing in India are so much more advanced than what we're doing here. They are so much farther ahead of us in terms of consciousness and understanding what the way the world is structured, than any of us here. And we know that because they're taking spears and fighting the police with them.
And not following and abiding to the rules of,
exactly,
in the name of COVID, stay home.
Exactly. And or even doing what the corporations are telling them to do. Here, can I give one more quote? And this gets me to what I think we should do. Cause I want to take some time to say, well, if teachers weren't gonna resist to go back in, then what would you recommend? And there was another story from this part of the story in India that really helped me, as well as my discussion with AJ, kind of clarify what I think we should do. So this is the last part of this tale that this guy was saying. He wrote, what one should note is that the farmers in India, have clearly articulated an anti-globalist agenda in their protest. They have turned against local globalist corporations owners, Ambani and Adani, those are, I guess, two businesses that have benefited immensely after the present ruling party came to power, and that's Modi, right? Ambani is also the owner of Jio Telecommunications and was handing out free SIM cards to capture monopoly of the telecom market. Happily, the protesting farmers are now destroying their cell towers, absolutely unconnected to the 5G protests, but so strangely connected. All right, so farmers are actually destroying telecommunication towers there. And I think that's, to me, there's a lesson there for us. Because I was thinking about what I think we should do. And I would vote to return. But I would vote to return to, yes, rebuild our ties with each other as workers. Yes, allow our students and the students we serve to at least come back together. And yes, it's going to be a daycare center. I'm not actually concerned about whether they get an education. It's just a place for them to come and be safe and be together and like interact and socialize. But I will say this, in the same way that those farmers are taking down 5G telecommunication, networks and things like that, I think when teachers return, we have to completely uproot tech from education. We have to no longer do Synergy, no longer do Google Classroom, Chromebooks out of the classroom. It's all pencil. It's all paper. We want tech out. And that is something that I think we would have to do, is like completely uproot every bit, like my Mac computer, I'm not using it any longer. We have to understand this is a fight for our future, and we're gonna start it here. And we're gonna actually go back to our schools, uproot all that tech. Now that's not gonna solve the problem. We are gonna have to spread that message. We will have to get other schools to do the same thing. Higher ed has to do the same thing. Lower ed has to do the same thing. And then of course, this is not just a tech around education. Tech is coming after Amazon workers. Tech is coming after Tesla workers. So if any one of those people experiences a struggle, then the same unity we had in uprooting tech, we use to support their struggle, to go on strike, and then the battle is on. And so that's what I would say, is I would say, we go back to our schools and say, we're getting this telecommunicate, or we're getting ed tech the fuck out of here. You're gone completely, purged. And if we start there, that still does not keep us from that future, because capitalism will move us. We will have to uproot capitalism. But I think that would be the beginning of sending a message about to other workers that we're with you in forging a different future.
I think this is where I would say, please take down our blog. I'm being serious. I'm not playing around. I'm not joking. This is the moment for anybody to start writing. Our email addresses. Look us up on BitChute, and just remember. We live in San Francisco and Oakland, so hold up a sign somewhere, even if our email addresses are confiscated from us. Put Andrew Libson. So, smoke signals work too. I agree with you. You are, you know, I used to consider myself, I was very young, and I'm a millennial, and I grew up with a lot of technology more than you did. I remember when computers were used even in elementary school, and I used to consider myself to be a Luddite. It's only that after my last phone, which wasn't a smartphone, got broken, and there wasn't any way for me to get another phone that was similar unless I paid high amount of money, or they made it very difficult, or I had to, there were challenges around it, and I had to get a smartphone. It's hard. I invite people to look at our episode where we discuss some of this stuff with Steven Rico and Tracy Burt, where they discussed how educators love digital devices, but there's little evidence that they actually help children, or any of us for that matter, really.
Well, and now we can see it hurts.
Especially those who most need help. Yeah. And just interestingly enough, there was an article that I shared during that episode that I would like for people to look at, by Natalie Wexler, that was done the 19th of December in 2019, just before 2020, where it talks about how classroom technology is actually holding students back. So I'm not going to go through it now, because people can find it, I'll link it. But I am in agreement with you in a lot of ways. I just think it's a very radical move. I think people are so attached to the devices. I think the phone is now becoming an extended hand. It's hard not to see your life with a phone, but it's doable.
And this to be clear,
sort of conversation.
I don't think I would be in favor of saying, we're taking your phone away from you. What I'm saying is, we as teachers collectively would uproot the technology that we see coming into the process of education. You know, we're still gonna, like, we have work to do with educating ourselves, with educating fellow workers about what's coming with this fourth industrial revolution. But if we could come to enough of understanding that is the future, that is the most dangerous future. It's not a virus future. It's a capitalist future that's around this great reset in the fourth industrial revolution. That is the biggest danger. Then I think we would be making progress. And I will also want to be clear that just getting tech out of education, one, it's not a standstill. They would find a way back. That has got to be the beginning of essentially rolling the whole thing back and support and going on strike, getting together again to build strikes that are about spreading the strikes and that are about taking back our world. Because it's not strikes about wages any longer. It's not strikes about pensions. That shit's going to be gone. At this point, it's going to have to be strikes about what is the future? Who's going to decide the future of society? People who want to use those robots to replace humans and use AI to replace mental labor and the people who teach as well as anything else, manage or whatever. Or do we want to actually have a society that's about connection and relationships and appreciating one another, living within that? And I kind of do agree with Allison that it's probably going to require a kind of simplicity It's not about CRISPR. It's not about, you know, vaccines. And it's not about special biomedical thing that makes you live longer. It's about people living in a more
rudimentary.
Yeah, I mean, and just in a more human way, something that is social and human. And we won't be able to recover that as long as capitalism is around. I at one point thought that we were going to be able to reclaim all our tech and make it so that, oh, we don't have to do these things. I'm less thinking that way. I mean, again, I don't know. I think there needs to be a revolution, but I am more inclined to believe that that revolution is going to be a simplifying of things for ourselves, a simplifying of what life really is about, and bringing it down to its core elements of relationships, of food, of housing, but of relationships and of community and of individual expression, because it's going to have to be a piece of that. And if it's not also about people being able to say what they think and believe and find places to be comfortable in a society, then I don't think it's any good.
Yeah, you are bringing me back to my permaculture days. For some people that may know me, and I've said this, I studied permaculture back in 2010, and I grow my own food, and as well as it's about sustainable living, but not because of the green movement or any sort of political environmental movement. It's just because there's more love and wholeness and humanity in living by the principles of nature, which is just, you know, earth care, human care, surplus share. And it sounds very hippy-dippy, but it is within us, I think, all of us. Even when people talk about, I used to do this at my protests, when I used to go to conservative communities to protest against genetically modified foods. I used to say to the conservative communities there, I remember one that's captured online, I used to say, God, at the time I was having issues around God, God made things natural, and we shouldn't oppose the way that God made things that are truly perfect in its truest form. And we shouldn't be tampering or playing around with any sort of genes that are already perfect in its truest form in nature. And that could be said as well for people who don't believe in God. I think that we just need to go back to, yeah. I think we're removed from the way that we used to think. But this is an interesting conversation that this has turned into. I agree. I find that most people are out of touch with their humanity, their place in nature, and technology is so embedded in our society that it is challenging to see our lives without it.
Correct.
And to go back into a classroom, as you were saying, with paper and pencil, which is doable because we've been doing it for how long before computers? Mm-hmm. I think it's a challenging conversation, Andy. I think it's a challenging one. And it's one that I would absolutely love. And when I had this discussion around technology in the classroom, back when my nephew was in pre-K, TK, transitional kinder, at a child development center, I said, you know, we are in opposition of technology. And what are you going to do for families like us to accommodate us? Because we don't want any sort of screen. We don't want tablets to be used. And we don't want teachers to use any sort of smart machines to be able to educate our students. I think that TK, any age really, can do well without it. And we've always done well without it. Mm-hmm. And I was looked at funny. I remember the educators in the meeting that we had, they looked at us a little funny. They're like, what is these people? So that just gives me a glimpse that it's just challenging. But I am in agreement with you. Yeah.
I'm glad we had this conversation. And, not everything here is like something that is, for me, is so worked out. You know, there are some things I really feel like I've worked out. Other things I'm kind of guessing, but these are what I believe. And like we said, we want to create the space for people to say what they believe and then we have to figure it out together.
Yeah. Well, at least I know what group I can share this episode with. The permaculture people. Yes.
By the way, there are a group of teachers who we are going to have a meeting next week at Mission to talk about tech in education. And so I think, and even, you know, my comrade Greg, who he and I have had some differences more recently, he is starting to talk more and more about the future of automation and the future of tech and education. And I'm not saying he's not concerned about COVID any longer, but it does seem to me like maybe his concern is shifting towards this trap that he sees being laid for us.
Wow. Because teachers are going to lose their jobs.
Yeah. And it's going to be an awful future. It's like the ones who do have the jobs, it's going to be a bunch of screens and a bunch of squares, and it's a numbers game. That's not education. Education is physical contact with each other.
I agree. We'll see how long I was able to raise a kid without a phone. I don't know if I'll be able to help my brother do that with his son.
Yeah.
The forces of peer pressure are very strong. They used to be about drugs. They're now about phones. They're still about drugs sometimes.
The phone is a much more dangerous one.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, before though, I should say that some exciting news for our future episode is we have Rob and Jake coming back to interview or ask us questions. Maybe is that okay for me to share?
Yeah.
As a get ready for an episode, a follow-up episode, I think that would be exciting.
Yep.
So I'm looking forward to that. I just wanted to say that before we conclude, because that will be an exciting episode where we're going to be doing the reverse.
And are we going to do the discuss the socialists against lockdown article next week?
Yeah. That would be really great. If AJ wants to join, we'll have Kenny on that one for sure.
Yeah.
Can I do something a little selfish here?
Go for it.
I want to just promote one book here. I finished this book. I finished this book.
Oh, I've seen that book.
Plainsong by Kent Haroff. Mm-hmm. And I'm part of a book club. And this book brought me back to the time that I lived in Emmett, Idaho, when I was 17 years old as a Jehovah's Witness, where I lived in a conservative town. And this talks about a conservative town in rural Colorado, and the dynamics and the relationships and the beauty were wonderful. But what I wanted to bring up was it reminded me of how wonderful the people were that I met in Emmett, Idaho. And even though they were conservative, politically they were on the right. And when Hillary Clinton said the deplorables, it was hard for me to cheer on with the rest of liberals at that time, because San Francisco is very above it, very looks down at that sort of small town mentality or the conservative sort of middle USA or even middle of my own country, where I know some people are very conservative. I've also lived in a small town in Mexico, and I know the way of thinking. And it just brought me back and reminded me that not to forget that even though some people are Trump voters, maybe not supporters like they see him as an idol, that there are differences, but there's still opportunity there for us to work with him, because every one of them that I knew of still have that humanity and that side of themselves that I know once we work out our differences, we're really working for the same thing, which is to defeat poverty and any issue that is there holding us back from our truest form to live our wonderful life together.
Yep.
But there are issues we need to work out.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so I recommend that book by Plainsong by Kent Haroff.
I like it.
All right. Thank you. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left? It was a weekly political podcast / channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes wherever you found this episode or on our blog. Write it down, folks. what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast last channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, subscribe, and turn on your notifications to any of our 6 platforms on Spotify, iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. You can also challenge anything that we've said here, like you said, offline, online. If you disagree, we welcome that. I'm Eduardo Valca with co-host Andy Lipson, and we look forward to Kenny
coming back.
All right.
All right. See you next week.
Ciao.